welcome on back to another fabulous edition of Skid Row Chatter with Tom Pitts. Tonight, our guest is Bob Mayer, the author of The Trouble Boys, The True Story of the Replacements. And he's here. Well, he's not technically here. He's somewhere at an undisclosed location, hopefully hearing me on the phone. Can you hear me, Bob?
I can. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I guess the next question is, can the audience? And let's hope so. We'll carry on until we're told otherwise. Where are you in the country right now?
I am actually in Memphis, Tennessee, where I live and serve as the music critic for the Daily Paper here, which is a Gannett USA Today-owned newspaper. So my sort of day job is writing about music here in Memphis, which obviously that's a big thing historically and currently. And I'm actually coincidentally headed back to Minneapolis, where the Replacements are from, this weekend to do some magazine stuff for Mojo Magazine, who I do freelance work for here in the States. And So I'm in Memphis at the moment, but I will be in the land of the Replacements, Minneapolis, tomorrow. So,
yeah, it's what my first thing is, you know, when I started looking up some stuff about, the book was already on my radar, and but I started trying to find out some stuff about you, and there's a lot written about the book, and there's a lot written about you in the book and your sort of involvement, but there wasn't a lot about you other than just the bare bones bio that I found. So, well, thank you for covering that. Do you consider yourself a rock and roll journalist at this point?
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what I've been doing all my life. I did about 3 months working at a trade publication in the late 90s and 6 months working in radio, kind of doing entertainment stuff. And then I got a gig working for the Alternative Weekly in Phoenix as the music editor, and then did the same thing for the Village Voice paper in Seattle, and then became a columnist, a music columnist and critic at Chicago Reader. And for the last 10 years plus, I've been the music critic here. So pretty much, with the exception of maybe a year, I've written solely about music, or music and entertainment, but for the most part music, the last frighteningly going on 20 years next year.
So let me do my little math there. I see. So with all those opinions and comments and input into music and bands and the scene, what made the Replacements the band that you wanted to make your breakout book, your career thesis? What was it
about?
Yeah.
Well, a few things. I mean, I think fundamentally I was had a kind of personal interest. I was always a fan of the band. I kind of have told the story that I saw them before I had really heard them. They did the very famous, or I guess infamous, appearance on Saturday Night Live in 1986. At that point, I was, 11 years old, I think, maybe, when they came on. And I had no idea who they were. I just saw this band, very loose, very loud, very raw, very unpolished, particularly in the context of the mid-80s, doing this kind of untethered TV appearance, and it sort of stuck with me. I just kind of made note of the name, and then about a year or so later, maybe 2 years later, I heard their first record, or the first record that I heard was Pleased to Meet Me, which was their second major label album in 1987. So I was hitting my teenage years, and it kind of was the perfect soundtrack for that. And then, just became like a lot of people who are Replacements fans, it's more of a love affair than a casual relationship, and just loved the band and was interested in their story for many years. And then as I got into the kind of professional business of being a music journalist, had occasion to interview Paul Westerberg, the singer and songwriter of the band, and Tommy Stinson, and write about them and their solo projects and their post-Replacements projects. Of course, by the time I got to it, the band had been broken up for many years. And so I sort of found myself drawing closer to this story. And I guess, like a lot of Replacements fans, I read everything I get my hands on. There had been a few things written about them. They were part of Michael Ozerod's, a chapter in Michael Ozerod's book, Our Band Could Be Your Life, though it really only covered up the sort of first part of their career. And there was, articles and Musician and Rolling Stone. I mean, they were not a band that, even though they didn't really achieve great commercial success in their lifetime, they were a band that was beloved by critics and written about and got a lot of press. So, they were not obscure. But I still felt like, having got my hands on everything that I could and reading about them and learning about them, there still seemed to be something kind of missing in the story or in the telling of their story. you know, there was a fair amount of tragedy that surrounded the band. Bob Stinson, who was the co-founder of the band and Tommy Stinson's brother, had died in 1995, you know, after being kicked out of the group in 1986. And so that was always kind of at the heart of it, a bit of a mystery and what had happened to him in terms of him leaving the band and his later life. And so I just thought, you know, there's a story here about a band that everybody thought should be way bigger than they actually were commercially, and yet still kind of haunts people and affects people and has influenced people. And so I kind of came at it from that perspective, really just as a curious fan and as a curious journalist trying to figure out, you know, what the story was beneath the surface.
You know, it's funny. With a band like The Replacements, too, there's so much that is based in myth.
Mythic.
And yeah. Storytelling. And even more so with those guys. And I a friend of mine who actually has a story in the Replacements book that Gutter Books put out, the crime writers anthology that
sure.
You know, they sing a song. And Steve Loudmouth, you know, he compared it to their mythology as a game of telephone, you know, that their fans played.
Yep.
And Replacements were always like, I first saw The Replacements, so I'm pleased to meet me tour. And I've seen him a few times after that. I saw Westerberg when he was touring stuff too. But it was definitely a band that I always felt like you would a party you would come too late to. You know that you would miss
right.
the real action, and you can only hear about it. What did you just want to uncover the truth? Did you want to set the story straight?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that was part of the attraction, particularly now. You look at bands, and I think in part because of the era we live in of social media and everybody having videos on their phone, the kind of myth of a band is very easily punctured, you know, because you have the reality. You have instant time reviews and instant time set lists and Periscope, and, you know, there's no mystery sort of left in rock and roll. But The Replacements, they were in some ways maybe not the last band necessarily, but one of the last bands it really kind of was bathed in this romance and this myth and these kind of tall tales and this, you know, game of telephone, as you say, about the things they did on stage and off. And I think that was an attraction to the story. It's like certainly uncovering what was real and what wasn't was an interesting part of the research I did for the book. And the funny thing, of course, is you think going in that you'll probably be debunking a lot of these extreme stories and, you know, hero tales and that kind of stuff. But I found in many cases some of the most extreme stories, the most ridiculous things, the things you would sort of assume were apocryphal, actually turned out to be true. And so there was a lot of truth to their myth, if you can sort of, if I can kind of use that, that's obviously a paradox, but, you know, they were larger than life. They were mythic. But then I also kind of was interested in investigating sort of the people behind the myth. And so I got into a lot of their family backgrounds and the pre-Replacements years of each of the individual members and how all that stuff ultimately came to shape what the band was and how their career unfolded and what their legacy would become.
Well, you know, I mean, I know it's Westerberg's band. It's his creativity mostly driving this, certainly the songwriting, and his, you know, solo efforts show it. Or the last album, All Shook Down, was like almost, it seemed to me, Westerberg and studio musicians. But the core, and what made me curious about them when I was young, is the brothers, Bob and Tommy. Mm-hmm. How much, when I was reading the book and seeing how far you had gone, yeah, talking to family members and just investigating that really, for me, would shed a lot of light on The Replacements. And it just, what is your take on, not the Bob Stinson tragedy, but just like how their family shaped, the Stinson family shaped what The Replacements became?
Well, you know, it's funny because for me, and some of this I may be looking back kind of understood that, you know, a band that was as extreme as The Replacements, you know, as extremely wonderful, as extremely fascinating, as extremely frustrating as they could be, as extremely destructive and self-destructive, you know, those kinds of extremes are usually the product of a kind of intensity in terms of your background or your home life or your formative years. And I think that's true to a man with The Replacements. And one of the things I did in the book was really talking about those personal stories and how they shaped them. You know, obviously with Bob and Tommy Stinson, they came from a very kind of troubled background. Particularly Bob sort of suffered the worst of it, you know, various kinds of abuse, and he was sent away in a sense to the state juvenile system for many years, and almost as a way to reconnect with the world, he kind of devoted himself to the guitar and developed this ambition to start a band. And then when he came home, Tommy, who was his 7 years younger half-brother, was getting into trouble, and rather than let him go down that same path, he kind of basically forced him into this band and into playing bass. And then Chris Mars, the drummer, you know, he had an older brother who'd had some very severe schizophrenia as a kid, and that left a mark on him. And Westerberg came from a kind of, you know, depressed, alcoholic sort of background, and obviously Catholicism and Midwestern sort of reluctance and repression ways and all this stuff. So for me, it was like, you know, a lot of times you read rock bios and the background stuff, the childhood stuff is almost kind of perfunctory. You know, sometimes it doesn't really enter or impact the group. But I think with the Replacements, it became very clear to me early on that, you know, where these guys came from and what they had experienced before they formed the group actually had a lot to do with what the band was and what they became. And, you know, both in terms of what their greatness was and what their chemistry and their power was, and also what their limitations were, you know, commercially or professionally. So, you know, it was a kind of thing of the research yielded a lot of that. I didn't know that going in, except I maybe had a little bit of an instinct that, you know, there's more to the story here that I don't know, and that maybe they've never talked about, and that did turn out to be the case.
How much of that that environmental influence do you feel is the city, the Midwest? I mean, it's the northern Midwest. As opposed,
yeah,
the family's definitely shaped them. But do you think there's something about, you know, they almost created the Minneapolis sound? But what do you think?
I mean, they certainly were part of the vanguard in the 80s, and you know, I explore that in the book. I do try and contextualize Minneapolis, the Midwest, to a great extent, but specifically Minneapolis in that era, you know, kind of coming out of the mid late 60s when they were kids, and then into the 70s where you know, Minneapolis had been a really thriving place in the 60s, and then by the, you know, musically garage rock labels, and by the early 70s that had all gone down, and it was sort of replaced by show bands and cover bands, and out of that kind of you know, stagnation, you have the birth of the first wave punk and new wave movement in Minneapolis, and the Replacements kind of came in on the end of that, but they were almost in a weird way, sort of a byproduct of that. But and then at the same time, they were so much of a product of their own little world. They were never really part of the scene until their first manager, Peter Jesperson, who was kind of a mover and shaker in that new wave scene and co-owner of Twin Tone Records, he sort of brought them into that mix. So I did, you know, in the book, I do kind of talk a little bit and try and give as much context as possible about, you know, Minneapolis in that era and where the scene was at and where the Replacements were at, and, you know, the kind of meeting when that happens in early 1980 when they sort of become part of that rock scene. But, you know, I think, as I say, it's all rock books aren't the same and they're not created equal. And it's like, in some cases, I don't think the environmental stuff, the formative stuff really is totally, you know, has an impact. But with these guys, I think it did. And I mean, I know it did after having written the book, but you know, even looking back, it's like you compare it to other groups and it's really fascinating just how much they were a product of their environment, both, you know, at home, of the scene they played in later in the sort of bigger alternative rock and indie rock scene of the 80s. In many ways, they were always reacting to their various environments, and so they are a kind of reactive band in a way. And to write about that, you have to understand what they were reacting against. So that's why I think in the book I try and provide a lot of context, these different contexts, whether it was their home life or what Warner Brothers was like circa 1985 when they signed with Warner Brothers and Sire. So you know, that kind of became a thing for me just in terms of the research too.
I mean, I remember I was in a band playing in those back in those, and I remember they were the first. Tim, that was a big deal, and you know, Husker Du came out, you know, that they were the, I think, the, and coincidentally also Minneapolis, but they were the next sort of considered punk genre band that got signed, and then it was an avalanche. But the Replacements were really, because, you know, I've never really considered them for whatever reason a punk rock band, and they get pegged with that a lot, even in the early days, but they just seemed so on their own. But let me ask you,
and it's,
you know, you mentioned the other rock and roll books. You know, I've read countless rock and roll books in my life, and they all, and the movie bios too, they always have that same arc. You know, the fame and fortune comes and eventually destroys, and that same, and I enjoy it. I still enjoy it, but but there was something absolutely different that I thought I was brilliant in spotting. And then I read some of the reviews in your book, and I realized that everybody pretty much spotted. You rewrote that arc, and did you set out? Was that part of your plan to just, you know, I'm going to make this not like any other rock and roll biography book?
Well, I think it was the story, you know, that dictated that, and what the truth of the story was, and that was kind of it revealed to me over time. I mean, I probably had one idea going in with the book, and came out with another. And yeah, I mean, the thing is, it's interesting. I've been very fortunate in that I've had a lot of nice reaction, and the book's done well. And I think why that is partly because the Replacements are in this weird sort of netherworld. As you say, most rock and roll books, at the end of the day, you know, there's a certain segment of rock and roll books that are about kind of reviving obscure figures and making a case for them and that kind of stuff. But setting those aside, the majority of books are about people who fundamentally become rich and famous and successful. And yeah, maybe they have, you know, personal problems or drug problems, and there is that arc of maybe they dip and they have a comeback. But at the end of the day, the stakes, relatively speaking, are very low because they've achieved this great acclaim or this great success or this great financial reward. Whereas with the Replacements, they were always kind of this band that was, you know, sort of famous or infamous to a certain level. They did get on a major label, but they were always chasing. They were scrappers. They never quite made it. And there's so much tragedy that just runs through their story, and so many near misses and so much self-destruction. And I just think there's a lot more relatable elements in their story. That is, if you're a guy, you know, in a band, if you're a musician who's been in a band knocking around in a van for years, you can relate to the Replacements. If you're a band that got signed to a major label, but sort of the dream, you fell short of the dream, you can relate to the Replacements. And even if you've been somewhat successful in the business or been in the business, you can understand the sort of industry machinations, because they were working in the highest levels. You know, they were on Saturday Night Live, they were at Warner Brothers. So I think the Replacements kind of traveled through these different worlds, the indie rock world, the major label world, the sort of, you know, cult status. They did rub shoulders with, you know, the rich and famous, and open for Tom Petty and Elvis Costello and Keith Richards and all that stuff, but they never were really part of that world. And so I think it gives kind of their story, it's somehow more universal or relatable to me, and I think that's why a lot of people have reacted to it, because it's not this world of decadence and private planes that some, you know, rock books end up being about.
Well, you know, fans, especially fans of Replacements and that kind of music, underground stuff, they hate success. I remember Camper Van Beethoven, when they first played this club in San Francisco called the I-Beam. And it, mm-hmm. I mean, was a tiny, tiny place, you know. But when they played there, I remember everybody thinking, they sold out. That's it. They're too successful. We're not going to, you know. And of course, they went further and further and kept on going. But the Replacements especially seemed like the fans wanted to keep it to themselves. And you know, stepping outside of being a fan and then going to see them at a giant show, or, you know, I saw them open for Petty too. And just like that feeling of, wait a second, I'm not the only one. I have to share, you know, my secret, you know. How much of fans hating success held the Replacements back?
I think it's an interesting question. I think the Replacements sort of, like a lot of bands, their sort of idea of what was expected of them and what was acceptable dictated a lot of things they did. I don't know that it came so much from their fans, because, you know, if you know Paul, he's not particularly, you know, bothered by what other people think. The interesting thing in terms of that relationship to success and the ideas of, you know, commerce versus art and independent labels and major labels, it's a really interesting thing, and really kind of exemplifies the contradictions in the Replacements. You know, they get, as you say, they sort of get lumped into this indie rock, punk rock world, and certainly the first album or two was kind of punk-y, but they were always more of a rock and roll band, and I take great pains to point out in the book, they were never a DIY sort of true indie band, kind of in the sense that we think of in the romanticized sense. They were always, I mean, I make the joke that none of them had a driver's license, so none of them could drive, so none of them could get to the gig. That's sort of the baseline for how un-DIY they were, undo-it-yourself they were. And they, in some ways, really wanted success, and they wanted the things that came with being taken care of. It just, you know, some of that was their own inherent laziness and their limitations, and some of it was just
seriously, too.
Yeah, and so, But then they did become sort of successful on an independent level, and then I think their eyes were opened when they signed to Warner Brothers, and the first album, Tim, was very well received, although it didn't sell well. So then they thought, well, you know, this is a band that had a very long life. I mean, they were together 12 years, and they went from being teenagers to guys in their 30s. And so I think, you know, the priorities and needs and wants and desires changed over time. I mean, they as I say, they went from being a band that was playing halfway houses, essentially, to a band that was opening for Tom Petty in front of 15,000 people within a period of 7-8 years. And so there is a kind of arc and development and growth. And I think in that time, you know, Paul and Tommy maybe wanted different things than Bob did. And that's partly why he ended up not in the band. And Chris certainly didn't want some of the commercial things or wasn't comfortable with them. And so that's eventually he was out of the band. And so I think, you know, there's this constant push and pull of towards success, but also, you know, being pulled towards success, but also being repelled by it, wanting it, but also not being comfortable enough to really go for it. And so I think that's, you know, that kind of constant sort of turmoil is really what sort of propels the Replacements and propelled the narrative of the book.
Well, like you say, they were offered the world on the platter, and a lot of that stuff, like the Saturday Night Live incident and right. A lot of other similar things, they kind of flipped off the world when, you know, I always, you know, when you're saying this, I'm like, think of the cover of Please to Meet Me, you know, the executive
right.
hand reaching out for the ne'er-do-well. And,
right, which
and
is based on a real thing, you know, of them at a party for the playback for that album, and they're shaking everybody's hands and saying, you know, please to meet me, the pleasure's all yours, you know, Tommy saying that. So yeah, I mean, and, you know, the other side of that, of course, is that the things they did, the wild, outrageous, and at the time seemingly self-sabotaging things they did, really became kind of fodder for their legend, for this myth that we discussed earlier. So in some ways, Paul and in particular, but the band in general, what they were doing was maybe short-sighted or self-defeating in the short term, but in the long term, it kind of fed this romance about them as these kind of rebels and rascals and all that kind of stuff. So I think in some ways, you know, now that I have some distance from the book, I see that their story really is about a band that had sort of lost the battle but won the war, you know, and it just took 20 years for the audience and for the world to sort of catch up to it, because by the time that they reunited for a couple of years here in 2013 to 2015 and they were playing, you know, Forest Hills Tennis Stadium, and there's 12, 13, 14,000 people, they're singing their songs back to them as these kind of generational anthems. It was clear that they had not, you know, failed, quote unquote, in the way that maybe their commercial career was seen in the 80s, but in fact they'd succeeded. But as I say, their path just was a little bit more winding than most.
Yeah, critically acclaimed finally pays the rent.
Only, yeah,
well,
only
listen,
took another 25
you know,
years.
I got to take care of one small piece of business before I ask the next question, because I am curious about what you put into the book. But very quickly, this is a copyrighted podcast solely owned by the authors on the Air Global Radio Network, and that is the conclusion of my business. You know, 10 years, I keep on hearing this, too. It took you, you spent 10 years putting together this book.
Yeah, I mean, that's almost accurate. I mean, it was really from the first moment that the idea came to me was 2004. I did my first face-to-face interview. I talked to Paul on the phone a few times, but I went to Minneapolis for a magazine assignment, and we met for the first time and kind of hit it off there, I thought. And there was a few things that happened in and around that time that both in talking to him and some of the other people involved in the story that I thought, well, you know, maybe there's an opportunity now that enough time has passed, you know, since the band broke up in 91 and Bob had passed in 95, that maybe these guys can kind of reflect on their lives in a way that would be serious and worthy of pursuing a book. Because, you know, frankly, a lot of their immediate assessment of the Replacements after the band broke up, because both Paul and Tommy were doing solo careers or other bands, you know, they weren't able to look back on it either fondly or seriously. They kind of tried to dismiss it, as you would if it was, you know, something that was maybe a millstone around your neck. So for me, going back to 2004...
It's like a relationship that you want to put
yeah, Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was the wounds were fresh, and the divorce, you know, the ink was still drying on the divorce. So it was a kind of thing where I think it took a decade or more for them to even really be able to kind of reassess or be able to look back at the experience. And so that was 2004. So that's like 12 years ago from the publication. But then, you know, it was a couple years later, where I first began really approaching Paul and Tommy and their representatives about wanting to do this. And I did a lot of that work up front because I felt like, you know, enough had been written and said about the replacements without their direct input. And I felt like to really do the story justice, you had to kind of tell the story from the inside out instead of from the outside looking in. And so I spent, you know, a good year or so really trying to court them and kind of present my vision for the book, which ultimately was that I wanted their participation but not their authorization, which is, you know, kind of a fine line, but that basically they would be involved and grant me the access that I needed, but that it would be my book to write. And frankly, much to everyone's surprise, they agreed. You know, Paul agreed, and then Tommy agreed, and so I moved ahead. And then it took another year. There was some sort of band business and some reissues that were coming out, and so they were tied up, and I was tied up getting the proposal. So I sold the book in 2009. So, you know, 2004 is the inception. 2007, I start working to get them involved. 2009, I sell the book and really start the research in earnest. And so it was about really 6 years, 7 years of research and writing, and another couple of years ahead of that, just kind of getting up to the starting gate. So, you know, I say 10 years, but it's you know, in some ways it might have been my whole life I've been kind of preparing to write it, you know.
Well, I guess in that case, it was a happy coincidence that it came out. It was timed pretty close to the reunion tours. I mean, you're able to get some of that stuff in the book.
Yeah.
Or is it just a Chicago show?
Well, no, I mean, I was working on it through the reunion, and in fact, obviously, it was really interesting because I had more or less finished the first draft of the bulk of the book, not the ending so much, when they decided to reunite. And initially, it was just going to be for three gigs, and it was really amazing, obviously, because I had been sort of buried in this book and this research at that point for about 4 years, and working on, you know, a story about a band that was long since defunct, and here they are. You know, I find myself whisked to Toronto as they're playing their first show in 22 years and seeing the band sort of come back to life. And so we kind of decided, just as a thing, to see how the reunion was going to play out. It actually took or went on a little bit longer than I thought. And then I was able to kind of, you know, do another pass at the book, do a rewrite of the book, and then also add a kind of ending and epilogue, which incorporated pretty much everything up to the last reunion shows in the summer of 2015. So, you know, the book is as current essentially as it's going to get. And we're actually going to leave the version of the book intact for the paperback that comes out this summer because really nothing else has happened. So yeah, I was fortunate in that, the story, they gave me an ending, if you will, with the reunion and a somewhat happy ending, although maybe somewhat bittersweet too. That's the replacement's way, but yeah, it kind of also primed the pump, I think, for people's interest in the book and their story because they sort of raised their profile again during that 2013 to 2015 run, and then, you know, disappeared just as quickly on, you know, saying this is our last show on stage in Europe, and then really a few months later, the next thing that comes out is the book. So yeah, I do owe them for helping me out with the way they ended things with the reunion.
Yeah, serendipity, absolutely. You know, I got to admit too. Although I saw them on the All Shook Down tour when they were supposedly sober there, and they were great. They were absolutely great and on the ball. For the previous times I'd seen them, they, you know, they were doing their thing. And
right.
But the final tour, I would guess they won't be back, but who knows? But they were absolutely great. There was that playful carelessness and joy about them that I had not seen before, and it lifted me up. I expected, just like you see any band 20 years after they finished, that it's going to be, you know, a little ho hum, a little phoning it in, you know. God knows, Soul Asylum, the Minneapolis bands that had, you know, trouble in the past 10 years with you know, keeping it up as per, but the replacements. And there was that weird, eerie feeling too that you mentioned where you're in a room with thousands and thousands of people that know all the lyrics, that know all the songs, and you have that, you know, that feeling like, oh, it wasn't such a secret after all.
I think it was an affirmation and a catharsis both for the fans that turned out to those shows and for the band. I mean, it's hard, as cynical as you might want to be if you're Paul or anybody else who's been kind of through the music industry ringer a little bit. When you're out there and you're playing your hometown and there's 15,000 people in a baseball stadium, or you're playing New York City and there's 14,000 people filling, you know, Forest Hills, it's hard to sort of not sort of be affected by that adoration and that victory. Like I say, that victory that was a long time coming in a way. And so I think it affirmed a lot for the band and the people around them, and a lot of the people who were in the book, their old managers, their old A&R guy, who the people who believed way back when, finally after 20, 30 years, that faith was rewarded in seeing that experience. So I think the reunion tour, I've heard Tommy say, it went on a little bit too long, and that might have been true. They did another round in 2015 after those big headlining stadium shows that they did. But I think in general, it was a good experience and a needed experience, both for the band personally, for the band's legacy, and for the, as it turned out, the many hundreds of thousands of fans who loved them and just wanted that one last moment and that one great show that, maybe not everybody got the first time around.
Speaking of sour, surreal notes, well, you weren't, but what was Tommy's take on his little run with Guns N' Roses?
That was interesting. In fact, it was such a, unexpected thing. I mean, when he got that gig, he had basically been doing, immediately after Replacements, he had his band Bash and Pop, which he's actually most recently revived. And then he had another band called Perfect, both of which were sort of beset by label troubles. And when the Perfect album, which he had worked on for a long time and was really had a lot of expectations for it, it basically got canned by the label, never came out at the time. I think he was just fed up. And there was a point in between where, he was working selling toner cartridges over the phone, sales. This is a guy who hadn't graduated high school, who'd never done anything other than play bass in a rock and roll band. And so when the Guns gig came along, or the opportunity to play with him, it's like, here's a job that he is so uniquely qualified for. The guy's the quintessential rock star. He's been playing rock and roll since he was 13 years old on a stage. So I think for him, the Guns thing, even though maybe musically a lot of Replacements fans were scratching their heads, it actually, I think, in some ways was the best thing to happen to him at that period, where it gave him a kind of stability, both financially and professionally, and a kind of renewed identity to say, hey, I can do this, I'm a professional. And he did it. In a lot of ways, he was kind of leading that band for a long time. As musically, he was the guy who was in it for, God, almost 17, 18 years, believe it or not, and played and was a co-writer on a lot of that stuff on Chinese Democracy. And so I think for him, he probably has a different perspective than a lot of Replacements fans. For him, I think he owes a lot to that opportunity that he had to kind of prove himself outside of the Replacements.
Yeah. Well, the command with that I saw in, I guess it was 2015 I saw, but the command that he had on stage seemed different than in previous times. He definitely see, and I kind of chalked it up to it being just him and Paul from the original band still playing, but maybe you're right. Maybe there was a little more maturity in what he was doing.
Well, I think Tommy really grew up so much. If you think about it, Tommy was in the Replacements 12 years, and when he got out of the band, he was basically 25, 26, and that, so half his life he had spent in the Replacements, essentially. And rock and roll is for almost anyone is a kind of extended or arrested adolescence. So I think it wasn't until the band was over, and maybe even a couple of his post Replacements bands were over, that he really, in some ways, while he was in Guns and living in L.A., kind of matured and grew as a person. I think he's a much different person than he was when he was in the Replacements, because he was so young during that time. And I think a lot of that, you see a lot of that kind of personal growth, that personal maturity, and also that professional maturity in him now, and what he's doing with his solo career and with Bash and Pop, the revived Bash and Pop. And it is really interesting. It's, he effectively was a kind of child performer. I think Paul puts it must have been like being a, child performer in the circus touring with the Replacements in the 80s. And so yeah, I think his life has probably, and he's personally changed the most out of anybody in that group, just because he was so young, when the Replacements were a going concern.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up actually mostly in Los Angeles. I'm sort of split evenly. I spent my first 13, 14 years living in L.A., and then we moved to Arizona basically when I was starting high school, and I did high school and college out there and got my professional start. So I'm a Westerner, more or less. I did live in Chicago. That was one of my stops, professional stops, before actually I came to Memphis. So I'd spent a little time in the Midwest, but I think in a way, being that I come from a completely different background out of any of these guys. I come from a very stable, you know, kind of a two-parent home, no addiction, no religion, really, any of that. And then I didn't really spend, you know, I lived in the beach in the desert. So it's a far cry from the kind of environment, the heavily, you know, heavy drinking, heavy Catholic, heavy cold Midwestern environment. So for me, I think it was almost an advantage in a way, because I came to this story, you know, with a kind of almost from an anthropological perspective. I was kind of studying this culture and studying these people and studying this environment in a way that maybe somebody who was grew up in that and wouldn't have the same perspective as I did, and hopefully that helps the reader, you know, kind of have the same understanding that I had to kind of develop and go through and find in the years of working on the book.
If you were to write another book about a rock and roll band, which I assume is probably somewhere on your radar, what band would you choose and why, if you haven't already and you're already working on it?
Well, you know, that is the funny thing, and I don't have a good answer, and I don't have anything lined up as such. I've certainly looked at a few bands that could be possible, but I tell you, you know, the Replacements almost spoil you for anything else, because you'd be hard pressed to find a story that hasn't been as picked over as this. And I think I was lucky, and the Replacements have been written about a lot. I was the first one really to get in there and find out what the truth was. And so, you know, there's that part of it. There's also the part of it where there's just drama all the way through. And they were, as I say, they were kind of in this interesting place where they were successful to a point, but really had a kind of a sort of weird career. And so that would drive a narrative. So I don't know. You know, I thought about it and thought about all the bands that have good bios and some that don't and some whose members are alive. And it's a hard thing to follow up this book. You know, it's just like there's nothing. And of course, the personal connection too. You know, for me, I was connected to this story and this band. I don't know. I mean, there's probably already too many books individually about like the New York Dolls story, and that's a finite story because it was only a couple records. And I know there's a guy who's writing Kurt Weiss is writing a book about Jerry Nolan, the drummer, and Nina Antonio's written some books about the Dolls. But I mean, I'm fascinated by the New York Dolls, David Johansen. Maybe he's someone who I think probably could write a really great memoir. So I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm dodging the question, but I don't really have a good answer, and it's something I've been thinking about. And you know, I mean, there are maybe some bands I would love to write a book about, but then there's also the question of, is it commercial? Is it something that somebody's going to publish, and is it the right book for me to be doing at this point? So that's kind of what I'm grappling with at the moment, but you know, fortunately there's still a little bit of life left in the Replacements project, so I got a little more time to figure it out.
Well, I would think so. I'm sure your publisher would like to nudge you and get you another one, but I think it's hard to find the kind of, I mean, there's tragedy in the Replacements, but there is without the tragedy, there's just a sadness and a soulfulness that you're right. It's hard to match, and you'd have to find someone who's been.
Well, you know, it's a human story, and I see it's a story about brotherhoods too. You know, again, it wasn't something that I knew going in, but you know, it's a story of this bigger brotherhood of the band, among the four of them. It's this story of the real blood brotherhood between Bob and Tommy. It's a story of a kind of brotherhood that formed afterwards between Tommy and Paul, and that's the one that kind of continues to this day. And so, you know, it's really a story while I tried to tell a bigger story about the music business and indie rock and the major labels in the 80s and, you know, the industry and all that sort of stuff, that was the bigger story. But for me, the more interesting part was the personal story, was the smaller stories of these guys and their relationships with each other. And, you know, they're deep, and in some ways they were very much unspoken between them. And so I got to be the one that kind of was decoding this or getting them to talk about it for the first time. And, you know, I don't know that there are too many rock and roll stories that have all the elements that the Replacement stories do. So, you know, I may move to the side and write a different kind of book next, and maybe it won't be about a band. But if I only write one band book, I'm glad I did this one, you know.
Yeah, well, it's become very quickly the definitive book on the Replacements. I do have one last question, just because
sure.
It popped in my head. I was about to close it, but I do want to know your opinion on
Do you feel that Bob felt betrayed by, well, by the band? Was that, you know, like Brian Jones? Is that something that drove him where he ended up going?
You know, it's funny, and that one of the really big things, and you know, the book is dedicated to Bob and his late son, and was this idea of understanding Bob Simpson as a human being, as a three-dimensional human being, because I think so much of what the Replacements legend has and sort of affords Bob is wild and crazy, you know, smoking and drinking Bob Simpson, the guy who wore the dresses and played great guitar and got kicked out of the band and died young, and yes, those are all sort of true parts of the story, but I wanted to understand sort of what drove him, and that's why I dug so deeply into the childhood stuff, but also stuck with him after he was out of the band, as I'm sure you read. You know, I kind of go back and forth at various points, even after he's out of the group in 86, and follow him through his life. And, you know, I wanted to understand the way Bob felt. Obviously, he wasn't around. I had some long interviews with him that had been, you know, unpublished, and some video interviews that I was fortunate to get. But I had to sort of fill his story with his wife and his sister and his mother and his, and you know, family members and people who knew him at the time and after the Replacements. And I think, you know, certainly there was a part of him that felt hurt or betrayed. I mean, after all, the band was, the germ of the band was his idea. It was his creation. He was the one that brought Tommy into it. And it ran very deep and dark, you know, between the two of them and between Paul as well. But, you know, Bob was also somebody who had problems and issues that were bigger than the Replacements and had nothing to do with the Replacements that would have, you know, in some ways his fate might have been sealed at childhood, and he might have had the same kind of ending if he had been just a cook and not a great rock and roll guitarist. So, you know, the Bob thing is really complicated, and I try and explain it as best I can, but I don't think there's any way to really know, and I tried not to assign blame so much, but I did try to show that, you know, this is a guy whose life was tragic on one hand, and maybe his ending was inevitable, but in the 35 years that he lived, he managed to create an amazing legacy and create this band and give music to his brother and sort of build this thing that, you know, people still love and people still look at him fondly. And so for all his troubles, he had a lot of triumphs too. And so I think that's really the takeaway from Bob for me in terms of the book. But certainly he was and is a huge part of that story. Even when he was out of the band, I think he was sort of the ghost in the machine, you know. It was his spirit and what his sense of the band was always part of the group. Even in the reunion, I think that his specter was there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And well, I thank you for shining a light on him and the Replacements and letting us know really what the hell went on back there. And I'm gonna wrap it. I hope you not too late for you out there in Memphis. And I think
it's not too bad, and I appreciate you having me on. And yeah, obviously the book is still available in hardcover, and we're going to come out with a paperback in June, and we're also going to do an audio book. So I guess the people that have long drives and long hauls, they'll get to do the audio version. But yeah, it's available from DeCapo, and my website is replacementsbook.com. So appreciate you having me on.
Replacementsbook.com. I searched around there on the internet and I somehow bump into that replacementsbook.com. And yeah, and get it. It will, even if you don't really know about the Replacements or never heard of them, there is a timeless Shakespearean tragedy that happens to these four young men that I'm sure will be snatched up and ruined by a movie maker sometime before you die there.
As long as there's a check involved for me, that's fine. No, I'm joking.
As long as it clears. That's one thing they say about the movie business. You got to wait till it clears. thank you once again. And I'll be harassing you through email or something to thank you more profusely. And we'll enjoy your next book in the next 12 years.
It comes out. Appreciate it. Hopefully sooner. Thanks, man. I appreciate the time.
All right. Thanks.